This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 12th of October 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, thousands of people have attended the funerals of victims of the twin suicide bombings which killed at least 128 people in Turkey's capital, Ankara. While no group has yet claimed responsibility, public anger is being directed towards the Turkish government. My guests Robert Fox and Sebastian Borger will discuss the consequences of the attacks and the other major news stories of the day, including Russia summons Britain's defence attaché in Moscow over newspaper reports claiming that RAF pilots were given licence to shoot down Russian jets in Iraq if threatened. We'll also explore the domestic political backlash faced by German Chancellor Angela Merkel over her handling of the refugee crisis. And we cast an eye over the start of the Britain Stronger in Europe campaign that will be trying to convince the public that leaving the EU is a risk not worth taking. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. So welcome one and all to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, defence editor at London's Evening Standard, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Sebastian and Robert, welcome to you both.
Hello.
Thousands of people have today attended funerals in Turkey for victims of the twin suicide bombings, which killed at least 128 people in the capital, Ankara, over the weekend. No group has said it carried out the attack. However, Turkish Prime Minister Ahmet Davutoğlu announced earlier today that ISIS is the prime suspect. He also said that authorities are close to identifying one of the suicide bombers. However, opponents of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan are blaming him for the deadliest attacks in the country's recent history, accusing the state of outright collusion at worst and serious intelligence failings at best. Robert Fox, certainly on the issue of intelligence failings, those that want to cast some blame on the government have a case, don't they?
They do, but these things are quite difficult to track. I do worry when people, it's one of the cheapest journalistic cliches, talk of intelligence failures. Well, everything's an intelligence failure. But there do seem to be some really piquant facts emerging about this story so far, is that it is believed, it's reporting not fully confirmed yet, but reporters who've been on the scene for some time, talking to the investigators there, one of the suicide bombers appears to have been the brother of a suicide bomber who was involved in a major attack in July. So there is a pattern here. What worries me most about the Erdogan Justice and Development Party reaction was that within hours of this happening, and this was largely in Kurdish causes for peace, that Turkish forces go in to attack the PKK. Pretty soon after, I don't think it was coincidental with or dependent on those attacks, but the PKK have yet again declared a ceasefire. I think they've seized a propaganda advantage there, because the big criticism of Erdogan is that the war that he seems keenest to prosecute is not against ISIL, but against the PKK, the old enemy responsible for X thousand deaths. It's very, very difficult. It's been a very long conflict. But the fact is that they've got the charismatic leader of the PKK in prison anyway, and they can talk to him. But this is a real mess, and it's a very important part of the Turkish mess. And it is down to Erdogan. It is down to his party, because for once you cannot blame the junta of Turkish generals.
Sebastian Borger, everything is set up in this to encourage the discussion of conspiracy theories. You've got a government that cracks down on the media, which even tried to close down social media over the weekend. You have pro-government press that are suggesting that the one I saw just before we came on air was that this was devised by Assad and carried out by the PKK. This is the sort of pro-government propaganda that is turning up. And you have a very, very tense atmosphere in Turkey right now.
Very awkward to look at from the outside. It's interesting, you know, we so desperately need Turkey in all sorts of ways, on the southern flank of NATO, as part of the refugee crisis, solution to the refugee crisis. Merkel is, the German Chancellor, is travelling to Ankara on Sunday, which is in itself slightly awkward, a fortnight before an election. You know, if I were the opposition in Turkey, I'd be not particularly pleased about that. But of course, yeah, we need Turkey. And then it seems to slide inexorably towards something which is looking very unsavory. I mean, Erdogan, who we all thought... Well, anyway, 10 years ago or 13 years ago when he came to power, oh God, an Islamist. And then he turned out slightly better than we thought, I think, initially, is now having Putin-esque kind of attitudes increasingly.
And Robert, regardless of who has carried this out, the fact that this is this isn't on the border with Syria. This isn't in a small town. This is in the capital, and it's 128 people who've been murdered. It's almost impossible to overstate how serious this is.
The atmosphere is very serious as far as one can divine it. And there's always been this tenseness around such events, particularly in the leading up to a crucial election, because... Erdogan has made it absolutely clear he is fighting for his survival and the survival of his vision for Turkey, which unfortunately looks increasingly autocratic. It's interesting, though, for the first time since Ataturk, as I was pointing out, it's an autocratic vision of Turkey in which the military, which has always been part of the Ataturkish state, and it's always been, they've always said that they march out of barracks when they staged coups, but they're prepared to take their uniforms off and go back. There have been six or seven military coups since the 1920s. But with Erdogan, it's something different. And I think there's something that we in the West, the non-Islamic world, don't get about this. Sufism is very strong. It's not just straightforward Sunnism. It is certainly not the Sunni view of the majority, as, say, espoused by the very heavily tinged with Wahhabism that you get from the Gulf. Now, the way that works, it works with this very, very intricate system, which is older than Turkey, the state today, which is the tariqat, the cults. And this is the tariqat. They're the underpinning of power. The most powerful is the Naqshbandi. And these are the real wielders of power. And with the coming forward of several avowedly Islamist leaders in Turkey, and the two principal ones are Özal before this, and now Erdogan. These are the people who really have the power. We don't understand it. We don't know really how they work. The thing that we do have to accept in the deep background, very significantly to this outrage, is Turkey is less and less the secular state that Ataturk, the founding father, envisaged. And that, as my colleague was saying, makes it very, very difficult to work the fit of Turkey in the security apparatus that's now required with NATO for the unfolding or accelerating a Levantine crisis, because it's not just Syria, it's Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Jordan, and probably going into the Gulf. But it is a linchpin because, of course, it sits between Syria and Russia. That's obvious geopolitics, and has a very ambivalent attitude to Russia.
Sebastian, where does Europe go next with Turkey? You say that Angela Merkel is heading there very soon. You know, Europe has just struck a deal with Erdogan on refugees. You take a you know, €1 billion in aid, and hopefully you can help us
keep a few of them.
Maybe sort of don't let so many get on boats. This is a relationship where the West needs things from Turkey, and as Robert just said, obviously, you know, when it comes to the fight against ISIS as well. And yet, increasingly, this looks like a very precarious partner to be working with.
We used to have Americans who came in and sort of knocked the Turks into shape, didn't they? That seems to have that option seems to have gone away. There doesn't seem to be any diplomacy coming out of Washington.
Truman doctrine doesn't apply anymore, Sebastian.
I think, you know, as I say, I think you give a very awkward signal in the run-up to elections, but you've got to go and talk to him. And so in that sense, I think Merkel going there and talking to him is a bit like Merkel going to Moscow talking to Putin. You've got to stay in touch with these people.
Let's move on now to Germany, where Angela Merkel is facing another issue, and that's the ongoing political backlash over the refugee crisis. One poll published yesterday in Bild am Sonntag showed that 48% of those surveyed disagreed with Merkel's handling of the crisis. On Friday, she came under fire from Horst Seehofer, Prime Minister of Bavaria, who's also chairman of the Christian Social Union. That's part of her coalition, of course, who threatened to take the government to court if it doesn't adopt measures to limit the flow of migrants and refugees into the country. Sebastian Borger, there was some excited chatter last week that Angela Merkel was going to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for Germany's response to the refugee crisis. It would have perhaps been a little premature, particularly since the initial sense of warmth towards Merkel's positioning on this seems to have evaporated somewhat.
Complete madness. I was in Berlin last week and my colleagues were talking about it excitedly. And I just thought, come on, guys, you can't be serious. Peace. When you look at what our relations with the Central and Eastern Europeans is, you know, let alone what you talk about, the increasing tensions within Germany. But, you know, talking to the Czech Republic, the Slovaks, the Hungarians, you can't give her the Nobel Peace Prize. Anyway. Is laughable. It's also laughable, of course, of Seehofer to talk about taking his own chancellor, the leader of his government, to the Constitutional Court. I mean, you know, the former Chancellor Schröder quite rightly said, you know, everybody makes a fool of himself the best way he can, and Seehofer is very good at that. But today they have agreed on what they call transit zones, so where they hope that people who have very little chance of staying can be kept and can be pushed back within a week or so. Whether that'll work, I mean, she has to move towards him, and she has to move towards public opinion. I think there's no doubt about it. There were 164,000 people coming into Germany in September. Absolutely no sign of there being any less in October.
But do you think that she underestimated the strength of German public opinion beforehand, or do you think she was just trying to? She truly believed that it was the right thing to do, and we'll work out the details later.
I think that for once, this politician who is the incarnation of being careful and working out solutions, looking at problems before then sort of making a suggestion, for once I think she did do what she thought was right, namely open the borders like that, without particularly thinking through the consequences. And of course, the problem with Germany always tends to be people then get totally overwhelmed with happiness, and you know, everybody talks about how lovely Germany is towards refugees, and then 4 weeks later they start realizing that the buses are full and there are kids at school who don't speak German, and then suddenly people start thinking about the consequences.
Robert Fox, is this perhaps a good example of how leaders can sometimes get too far ahead of their people?
I'm interested in the very old-fashioned lexicon in which you're describing this whole thing. I kind of see two things working with Merkel on this. One, she sees the glaring and appalling demographic deficit of Germany long-term, with less and less proportion of the population of working age or capable of working. And I think that was behind her thinking. By the way, it was the kind of thing that Thatcher, no mean scientist herself, and actually understood demography and climate change, and I'm talking, and I've talked to her about it 20 years back, understood it better than anybody around. She was trying to find a politician's answer to a very, very long-term problem, and I do give her credit for that, and it's backfired. The other thing, I don't much like going in for this when journalists become pop psychologists, but you do have to remember her upbringing. Her upbringing as the daughter of a Lutheran pastor in East Germany, and the enormous movement of distressed people across Germany and Europe.
Well, that's not even pop psychology. I mean, she said herself
this is the way it works. But where I think the critics are wrong is that they equally are committing the kind of sin that they accuse her of. It's a knee-jerk reaction. How on earth are you going to deal with this problem? Because as Sebastian said, and by the way, it's a problem I've looked at for 30, 40 years nearly, particularly in regard to the Mediterranean and Italy, Spain, Greece, and so on, that these sort of chop logic answers that you come, and we the journalists are just as much to blame as the politicians. This is a very long-term trend. It is a very long-term trend what the great French historians, Brodel, Fevre, and Bloch would have called part of the longue durée. It is a fundamental change in the social nature of humanity. These huge numbers of people which are now in play. Sadly, in the public domain, whether media, in political debate, I hardly see any serious discussion of it, save for one. Curiously, the unsung UN Department of Population, which gives regular updates about its projections, and the last one that came out this summer in August is quite shocking, that says, look, we've got to track this, we've got to track this. Because when you go to the Departments of Strategic Studies and so on and so forth, they would say this is horizon scanning or over the horizon. Well, as a very, very good strategist, actually working for the RAF, said the horizon has come a damn sight closer than most people realise. So this is the problem. Are we going to talk about displaced persons camps? Are we going to talk about expulsions? Return where to? How do you manage? Who's going to do the security? Who are going to be your guards? It's a fundamental question here. Nobody seems to have an answer to that. But I do understand why Eastern Europe is scared about this. And it's part of another phenomenon in terms of ungoverned movements or shifts of population. And it relates to the Roma. The Roma are an enormous presence in Europe. And the reason why there is so much anti-feeling towards them is they don't play to the rules. The fear is that a lot of these new refugee communities in number will become almost feral. And that is the image, and that is why we're getting such a hard backlash now. It fuels, obviously, people like Geert Wilders. It fuels the Home for Our Own People parties, and it's going to colour totally the referendum on the European Union membership in the UK.
We'll come on to that in just a moment. But Sebastian, to then bring us back to then what Angela Merkel can or cannot do. She's in a very difficult position, isn't she? Because, you know, even if she were to take the view that, you know, what she said originally was right, it was the right thing to do, where it goes next from here, how you deal with those numbers coming in, how you deal if more people are going to arrive, that work hasn't been done yet, regardless of whether she can bring people along with her.
I think that's going to be the defining moment now. She's approaching, of course, next month is the 10th anniversary of her getting into the chancellery. This is the defining moment, and she'll have to take particularly the very powerful premiers of Germany's regions with her, and I so far I don't see it.
Okay, we'll leave it there just for now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, and my guests, Robert Fox and Sebastian Borger. We're back in a moment.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
And you're back with Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Still with me in the studio, Robert Fox and Sebastian Borger. Now, over the weekend, Russia summoned Britain's defence attaché in Moscow over newspaper reports which claim that RAF pilots were given licence to shoot down Russian jets in Iraq if threatened. According to these stories, RAF Tornados in Iraq had been fitted with heat-seeking missiles designed for aerial combat. All sides are saying there's absolutely no truth of it in it. Robert Fox, whether it's true or not, it does highlight, does it not, the fact that we're in a very precarious situation where lots of people have lots of planes in the sky around the same sort of place.
And whether their IFF systems coincide, that is identification friend or foe, and they are quite liable to get confused or conflicted. I don't think the Russians have been, I mean, you can accuse them of a lot, but you can't accuse them really of being over casual about this. They've consulted the US a lot, contrary to what was being said in this country. Lavrov and Kerry talk almost daily. And I think that the very thing that you read out, that they called in the defense attaché and not the ambassador, I don't think it was a carpeting. There was a bit of a head scratching. They said, you know, look here, Biggles, what's all this about then? they would say, because, as you rightly said, that they're very capable as attack vehicles, but they're not multi-role, these Tornadoes, or not when I last looked. They're pretty old, and I don't think that they could go firing Sidewinder missiles, because if you took up Sidewinder missiles, you would have to drop a lot of the other rather crucial kit, sensors and so on, as well as their ground attack, GPRS-guided weaponry, and there are very few of them. I think even, you know, you may think that Biggles is addicted to his white scarf streaming from his cockpit still, like the fighter pilots of old, but they're pretty well briefed about this, these pilots. This is one of the easiest questions, can I say, that you've asked us this evening. I mean, it smells, it's a two-word answer. Daily Mail.
Completely nonsensical article. No proper source. And whatever military expert you talk to says, well, you know, they've got these missiles, have had them for the last 15 years, but, you know, they wouldn't want to carry them in the first.
But they're not even armed.
In some ways, Sebastian, are you
Someone is stirring trouble, clearly.
Well, yes, but the fact that that is happening, and the fact that you do have, Russian jets in Syria, plus, you know, American and British and Canadian jets in Syria, and who knows whether Russian jets are going to start flying into Iraq as well. There do need to be these lines of communications, don't there?
Yes, well, and
I'm sure they're pretty good, actually.
As Robert says, I mean, I don't know, but I simply assume that they can't be stupid enough, either side, both the Russians and NATO stroke the US, they can't be stupid enough not to talk to each other and to say, well, look, guys, whatever we do, let's avoid firing at each other. Come on.
Okay, we're going to end by turning attention to the fight to stay in or leave the European Union for us Brits. Pro-Europeans launched their campaign today. It's called Britain Stronger in Europe. You can see what they're trying to do there. Robert Fox, we've got a very long time for this debate to play out between the two sides, those who think we should stay in, those who think we should leave. And at the moment, it seems to be a little bit of a phony war, because we still don't know what the debate's actually going to be about, because David Cameron hasn't come back from Brussels clutching a piece of paper saying, I have the renegotiation, this is what we're fighting for.
Well, I don't think the renegotiations actually will be substantial in the outcome. But I agree with you that it is a phony war, and I agree with you if you were to bring in the short-term or quotidian daily calendar of politics. Cameron's a bit stuck, frankly, because he's got three really important elections that now look as if they're going to get in the way before there can be a referendum. As we heard from Sebastian, obviously, there are the German elections. There's the Scottish Assembly, very, very important now.
That's next
in
year.
In May. And Poland's elections, because Poland isn't going to move or do anything until they've got their elections.
Can I add in the French presidential election in 2017 as well?
Sorry, guys. Poland is in end of October, as is Turkey is early November. Germany and France are in 2017.
But
it's gone.
He's going to have to do it in 2020.
Next
Sebastian,
year.
We're going to have a real debate here.
Next year.
I don't think he can do it next
Absolutely.
Year.
Absolutely.
Because he's got some real problems. Because there's another thing in my field, curiously, which most journalists don't pay attention to because it's toys for boys. But in defence and security, he's got some real problems coming up now. He's talked himself, Cameron, I mean, into taking a vote on aerial action by the RAF in Syria. And he's got to do that looking at my watch, within about 3 weeks from now, at least. And they have decided that they're going to take before Christmas the vote on renewing the Trident so-called independent nuclear deterrent. I say the so-called is the independent.
Let's not go there.
We're not going to get into that now.
And he's got a very difficult defence review, which looked as if it was going to be easy peasy. It is not now. And because covering all that is going to be the comprehensive spending review, what we're going to spend, which is going to bring in huge cuts in welfare. So I think that Cameron's going to be in difficulty before he even can draw breath and say, this is what we're going to do about the EU.
Sebastian Borger, there is the issue, aside from all those things that Robert just mentioned there, the fact that aside from all of that, is that the discussions, the actual negotiations between Britain and its European partners haven't even properly begun yet. They're sort of all sort of dancing around the edges. There's no chance of a deal before the end of the year.
I disagree that it's a phony war. I think it was high time. It was high time that the pro-Europeans, or at least the ones who are actually Eurosceptics, like Stuart Rose, he was always a Eurosceptic.
This is the chair of
the
Britain,
chairman
the
of
stronger
this new
Britain in Europe, the former
Britain
head
stronger.
Of Marks and Spencer.
Absolutely. A Eurosceptic, but a clever Eurosceptic who says, if it comes down to leaving the EU or staying in, we must stay in on better terms. And, you know, it's improving. There are reforms happening anyway.
And that, Robert Fox, is what is going to, if anything, win it for the inners over the outers, isn't it? It's people like Stuart Rose saying, look, I'm not a fan of Europe, but when you look at it, it's far better for us.
Agreed. Sorry. It's the lumpen isolationism of the outs, which is really causing damage. Farage played his one card, and he doesn't know whether it's a trump, an ace, or a two. And it's all about migration. There is a growing feeling, even in this country, amongst the sentient people, in other words, the sensible people, migration is a huge problem, but it can only be solved collectively and on a European basis, because the big crisis is in Europe's very own backyard.
Very quickly, Sebastian Borger, does this whole debate over whether Britain stays in Europe fill you with dread, or is there a tiny bit of you that thinks, you know what, this could actually be quite good fun?
It's fun. It is fun. No, and it's also very relevant. You know, I keep saying the Brits keep raising topics which are important, no doubt about it.
There we are on that note. Sebastian Borger and Robert Fox, thank you both very much indeed. That's thank all you. For today's Midori House. It was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Henry Rees-Sheridan and Federica Romaniello. The studio manager was Sean Malervi. Thomas Lewis is here next for the next half hour. And then it's Culture with Robert Bound. That's 1900 hours. Don't forget, tomorrow we're at Frieze Art Fair. Rob's your host. Do stay tuned for that.